This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois Hotel Association head Mark Gordon says Airbnb is shorting cities on taxes, cities like Bloomington Normal, and undercutting hotels.
We're fine with competing. What we don't like is government giving them a free pass by not collecting the full amount of tax.
GLT's Ryan Denham reports on Airbnb in the Twin Cities. As Independence Day approaches, hear the story of a Union soldier fighting in the Civil War as a man, even though the Central Illinois resident was born as a woman. Get a behind-the-scenes peek at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, and Mayor Chris Koos is in the studio to talk about a new multifamily residential recycling requirement in Normal. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's July 3rd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Shootings continue in Bloomington Normal. The Normal Town Council passes a recycling ordinance, and the council approves road repair money. GLT's Charlie Schlenker covers all of that and more with Chris Koos, the mayor of Normal.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Koos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Always happy to be here.
The council passed a recycling ordinance allowing programs for multi-unit dwelling places. It was a 4-2 vote. That's a little more divided than a lot of votes. Is that because it was a case of a clear distinction in political philosophies, more so than usual on the council, or just active stakeholders that are lobbying?
I think it could be a little mix of both on that. I mean, one council member certainly has strong feelings about these kinds of things. Another council member was concerned about the process, and it may have been because that person wasn't involved in the process in terms of the committee that was formed to take a look at it. This has been something that's been a long time coming and has been talked about by council and people in multifamily residences for 3-4 years now.
What do you think the pass along will be to renters for places that that do choose to offer it?
Well, I think, you know, the market's going to drive a lot of that. I think the property owners are well within their right to recover their costs from their tenants. They're providing an additional service. So we'll have to wait and see what that looks like.
What provisions did the town make to prevent this from being a burden?
It's giving property owners a year to come into compliance, primarily into compliance, and another 4 years to come into full compliance with the ordinance. We don't have time to get into the details of that today. But basically, I think this first year is key. There's going to be some learning curves on both sides, and including the town. And there may be changes that we have to make. I referred to that as much last night, that this has to be common sense solutions, and it's got to be fair to both parties involved.
Is it fair to start it without it being a finished product? That was one of the knocks from Councilmember Kathleen Lorenz, who wanted a little more delay.
I think we have the opportunity to do that. Kevin McCarthy and I both stated that publicly, that we know that this is a work in progress. The problem with trying to second guess every issue that might come up in an ordinance, it creates an unbelievably large volume document where you're trying to cover every unknown or unexpected. So to keep it open and to work with the property owners and to work with the tenants to make it a workable situation is to me a preferred solution.
Make the case that is the town's pattern and practice for ordinances. That yes, we'll start this and then revise it as needed.
Oh, you're going to catch me off guard. Never ask an old man to sneak up on an old man with a question. I think it's just the culture of the council that you know, if there has been pushback on an ordinance that we have passed because of unintended consequences, the normal town council does not have a history of digging their heels in and saying that's the law. We'll work with the aggrieved parties.
How pronounced do you think the benefits of this ordinance will be?
Well, I'm very hopeful that it'll continue to significantly reduce the amount of material going to the landfills, which is going to cost everybody a lot of money in the coming future as landfills close and we have to transport that that product further away from our community.
What can you say to large apartment owners like the Snyder Corporation and Steve Snyder, who were so vociferously against this?
Well, you know, Steve brought up an issue on Ironwood Gardens, which I tend to agree with. Our ordinance does not address a large, large property like that that covers a lot of ground. So I think he has a fair complaint that we have to address.
How do you think that can be done?
It'll be done through staff interaction and with the Snyder Corporation.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. There have been two or three more shooting incidents in just the last week. You said at a recent GLT community conversation on gun violence that we hosted after seven people in 2 months lost their lives in Bloomington Normal to gun violence, that this is an issue you care a lot about and have worked on with the U.S. Conference of Mayors. What have you done? What has been your involvement?
You know, the U.S. Conference of Mayors and primarily Mayors Against Illegal Guns and Moms Demand Action, which have come together, are really trying to address the issues, lobbying state legislatures and the federal government to crack down on the illegal trafficking of guns. And there is a significant amount of that going on. There are loopholes in purchasing guns at gun shows. There are group buys that are being done in other states, and those guns are being brought into Illinois and sold on the street. This has exacerbated the problem, and it's only one part of the problem. I think you'll realize that you'll remember that Chief Leishner said that a number of weapons that they recover are stolen weapons. So there's not a
about 40% nationwide.
Yeah. You know. There's not a checkoff. There has to be multiple solutions. People have to be more responsible about keeping their guns. There has to be better background checks on guns. And there has to be a crackdown on repeat offenders who traffic weapons illegally.
You haven't mentioned the social issues involved in gun violence. You haven't mentioned the social issues involved in gun violence. The either hybrid gang or cliques or alternative gang activity, the loss of community that is and economic opportunity that is promoting the kind of mindset among these young people that get guns.
This is a very strong issue, and there are groups trying to do things to engage youth in more positive activities in the community and give them an opportunity. I think you heard it very strongly that night. Boys and Girls Club is very very much doing good work in the community for that. There was a gentleman that was talking about apprenticeships and programs to get people on a path to well-paying jobs. Things like that are important.
Has the city been targeting, or has the town, has the area, have these community groups been targeting the right people for that, though, in the right ways? Because we're starting to hear that this latest rash of shootings is more fatal than usual, certainly, but it's not more frequent. So have we been missing the boat on this for a number of years?
I don't know, Charlie. That's a hard one to answer. There are things proactively that we try to do as a community. There's only certain things that a municipal government can do. We rely on private organizations and places like Boys and Girls Club, Western Avenue Community Center. We were a recipient of a grant from State Farm, and we have on staff a social worker working through the police department that is identified to work with at-risk youth, people that are being identified as going on a path that's not good, in the age of groups of, say, 10 to 13. And that program has been very successful.
Economic mobility, economic insufficiency, that's a fairly intractable issue nationwide, let alone in Bloomington Normal.
It is.
How can that be more addressed beyond just the apprenticeship programs that
I think
that
everybody
mentioned?
Has to be at the table, and you can't look for government to solve it, too. You're going to have to look at families, and families are going to have to work with social agencies and schools and whoever to solve this problem. It's all hands on deck to get this thing fixed.
What hopes do you have for the Youth Summit announced recently by the Not in Our Town movement and the United Way of McLean County? You were quoted in that as supporting it. What do you think that will bring?
Well, I hope it just continues to bring awareness to the issue and bring a call to action to this issue. If you recall, years ago, there was a significant crackdown on drug trafficking and gangs. And it was the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington and McLean County. And they enlisted the faith-based community to help with that. And that group rallied pretty strongly to send a message to their congregations and the community as a whole. So I think things like this help to raise that awareness and call people to action that we do have an issue here and we need to deal with it.
You were a soldier once and young.
As the
quote goes, you have used an M16.
I have.
Tell us that experience and how that differs from ordinary guns.
An M16 is a very specific piece of equipment, and it was highly designed and modified over the years with the intent of shooting people. That is the purpose of an M16.
Should you have resisted the suggestion that the town and city ban AK-47 style weapons or assault rifle style weapons in the past as bad policy and unenforceable? Is that something you would reconsider in light of the latest rash of violence?
Well, the reason I haven't touched that is one of the reasons is anything we do like that has to be done in lockstep with the city of Bloomington and possibly the county. But if you'll recall, the state of Illinois took that home rule authority away from municipalities, and we're not allowed to pass ordinances like that.
Mayor Chris Koos of Normal, thanks for your time on GLT Sound Ideas.
Good to be here.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, providing quality retirement living options in Bloomington Normal for more than 35 years. Independent living apartments and duplexes, licensed assisted living, and skilled nursing care available. Information at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get a behind-the-scenes look at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. You'll hear from the sound designer who helps set the mood. That's still to come during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Local hotels say they're struggling, facing too much competition, less demand from companies like State Farm, and a glut of rooms. Hotel operators say another emerging challenge comes from Airbnb, the short-term rental platform known in big cities and vacation spots. They want local governments to step in and regulate. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with local Airbnb hosts who push back on those concerns and say the unique Airbnb culture makes it a totally different business model.
A semi-pro baseball team, a band performing at the Castle Theater, a mom visiting to watch her son play football, a family reunion, an author writing a book about historic Route 66. They've all stayed at Kevin Lewis's house, one of the top Airbnb destinations in Bloomington Normal. Lewis turned his 103-year-old bungalow on Locust Street into a short-term rental property, first as a way to make some extra money during a financial slump, and almost 2 years later, he's still doing it.
Financially, I don't need to now. Now I do it because I like it. I enjoy it. I'm a schmoozer and a people person anyway, so it's not unusual for me to spend a couple hours in the evenings with my guests, hanging out, talking, getting to know them.
In bigger cities and vacation destinations, Airbnb is now just part of the vernacular. 10 years after launching in San Francisco, Airbnb has survived horror stories and big city regulation to emerge as a poster child for the sharing economy, a go-to choice for travelers looking for a homey place to stay. Lewis is part of Bloomington Normal's nascent Airbnb scene, which now has dozens of regular listings. While cities like Chicago began tackling Airbnb regulation years ago, downstate markets like Bloomington Normal and Champaign are only reaching that point now. On one side are traditional Bloomington Normal hotels, many of which are struggling with low occupancies and see Airbnb hosts as unfair competition because they don't pay the same local hotel taxes or abide by the same guest safety rules. On the other side are Airbnb's loyal guests and hosts who say home-based, short-term rentals meet a consumer need that hotels simply can't replicate. Caught in the middle are local governments like Bloomington and Normal, which have seen flattening or falling tax revenue and consider Airbnb as a potential way of refilling the coffers. The Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association has asked the Bloomington and Normal councils to take swift action on Airbnb regulation. Normal City Manager Pam Reese told GLT that city staff is researching the issue.
This is an issue that demonstrates how technology has driven a market faster than we can react to it.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner says he too is interested in the issue. Here's how Reese puts it.
Yes, we're willing to look at the topic and figure out what solutions we could potentially come up with for the problems associated with short-term rentals and the impact, but there are no easy solutions.
Kevin Lewis welcomed his first Airbnb guest at his Bloomington bungalow back in November 2016. Was it weird for him that first time having some stranger stay in his house?
You know, you're opening up your home to people that you don't know. There's always that trepidation, you know, is it going to work out? And I say I've had over 250 reservations completed, and I have yet ever to have an issue with any of my guests. They've always just been beyond reproach, full of integrity, always very pleasant, very nice people. So, yeah, it's been a very rewarding experience.
To be safe, Lewis has added a new rider to his State Farm homeowner's insurance on top of Airbnb's coverage. Lewis objects to claims by local hotel operators that Airbnb doesn't pay its fair share in taxes. Indeed, Airbnb does collect and remit state hotel taxes for Illinois bookings, although the Illinois Department of Revenue declined to reveal how much, citing taxpayer confidentiality. The concern now, according to hotel operators, is that Airbnb doesn't pay local hotel taxes. That's separate from the state tax. Bloomington and Normal City governments collect that 6% hotel tax, a portion of which goes to the Bloomington Normal Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. Bloomington collects $1.6 million in local hotel taxes annually. Normal collects about $1.3 million. More and more municipalities are considering short-term rental regulations because of that revenue opportunity and potential guest safety concerns. That's according to Mark Gordon, president and CEO of the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association, which has pushed for more regulation.
We're fine with competing, but what we don't like is government giving them a free pass by not collecting the full amount of tax and basically not regulating.
Mayor Renner from Bloomington says short-term rental regulation was a hot topic at the recent U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting he attended in Boston. But he says there's not yet a good model ordinance being used in another city that would inform Bloomington's efforts.
I would say it's somewhere around second tier. Second tier doesn't mean it's not important. It just obviously 911 communication and expanding the local economy, minority police relationships, obviously crime generally, those are tier one.
Chicago's two-year-old attempt at regulation has been plagued by legal challenges, delays, and uneven enforcement. Here's Pam Reese from Normal.
It is something that we're going to talk about, and whether or not it makes sense to implement the hotel motel tax and make it more of a lodging tax, so it does apply to short-term rentals.
Airbnb guests and hosts interviewed by GLT are open to some limited regulation, but not more taxes. Kevin Lewis is one of them.
Beyond that, I mean, if they want to regulate it, I'm fine with that. Being a super host, it's pretty evident that the services I provide and, you know, the amenities and the location and the condition of the home and everything exceed people's expectations, so I wouldn't have any issue with that.
Champaign's Airbnb market is more mature, typically with 4 to 5 times more listings than Bloomington Normal. Yet even with more properties, Champaign has only received a few citizen complaints related to them.
It's my understanding that we have a lively scene, but it's not overwhelming.
That's Ben Leroy, the associate planner for the City of Champaign's Planning and Development Department.
We have not been either flooded with complaints from angry neighbors, nor have we been besieged by a bunch of people who, you know, keep wandering to the city asking, hey, do you license this, or what do I need to do at an Airbnb?
He says Champaign City staff is now exploring options for licensing, regulating, and possibly taxing short-term residential units, with plans to bring a menu of options to their city council. He says collecting local hotel taxes is doable, but it may be burdensome on staff resources. They could also try to work out a tax remittance agreement with Airbnb directly, like the state did, though he says that's a less transparent option. Another option is to just not collect the taxes at all.
There are trade-offs there, so our job as staff is to dig into those trade-offs, present them to the city council, and ultimately, yeah, it's council's decision about which path they want to pursue.
One reason municipalities are slow to enact restrictions is that any monitoring or inspection regimen would be a nightmare because there are so many Airbnb listings. That's according to Peter Tomaris, a veteran of the Champaign-Urbana and statewide hotel scenes, who now works as a hotel consultant.
Even though municipalities everywhere are looking at it, they're just not getting around to doing anything about it.
The Airbnb issue is similar to one faced by Bloomington and Normal governments in 2015, when they began regulating ride-sharing businesses like Uber and Lyft. They created an annual fee for a so-called Transportation Network Company, or TNC license, allowing TNCs to do their own background checks and vehicle safety inspections. Now is the time to enact regulation on home sharing, says Ray Cerisa, president of the Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association.
60 Airbnb listings, that's 60 hotel rooms. That's, they're taking away 60 hotel rooms from us. Now, Airbnb is not going away, just like Uber and Lyft aren't going away. But and we recognize that, and all we ask is that they play by the same rules that the hotels have to.
Steve Heisler of Normal said comparing his ranch-style home to a hotel is apples to oranges. Heisler and his wife, Kathy, travel a lot, so they rent out their house 6 to 8 months out of the year. They don't accept any one-night bookings or corporate visitors via State Farm or Country Financial, and they want out-of-town travelers who stay at least 2 nights.
They didn't know about the short-term demand in Bloomington Normal. I was blown away by it. So it was very successful from day one.
I spoke to Heisler by phone from Washington State, where he's staying at an Airbnb at the base of Mount Rainier. I asked him why Bloomington Normal visitors choose Airbnb. When there's a glut of local hotel rooms, they're getting cheaper and cheaper.
We're dog-friendly, which is huge, where a lot of hotels, most hotels, are not dog-friendly. So that is a big plus for me. I think the hominess, we have a full kitchen with all the gadgets and appliances that some people have actually baked when they come to the house. So I don't say we're competing with hotels because they get the overnight traffic, they get the business travel. I don't want that kind of person. So I'm offering something that their traditional hospitality, they're not offering. Not that they couldn't, but they just, I don't know, they're not willing or they're not creative enough.
Bloomington Normal hotels are struggling with low occupancy rates, which Ray Cerisa pegged at a dismal 44% this spring. He says short-term rentals like Airbnb were one of the reasons. Rachel Iverson of Bloomington disputes that. She rents out her home up to 5 days a month and uses Airbnb as a guest twice a year. She says it's cheaper to travel that way, and she likes how her hosts become a built-in guide for the trip.
Airbnb kind of has a culture. People who are willing to open their house to strangers, it takes a certain kind of person. And so I really enjoy getting to meet people through the experience of staying in their house.
A bigger reason for those low occupancy rates, she thinks, is all the new hotels that have opened up in the past several years, like the Hyatt Place in Uptown and the Radisson in North Normal.
It's not the same people that are staying in hotels or staying for Airbnb. So I know that it does impact somewhat, but not nearly like in any significant way, especially in a small town area like Bloomington Normal. I mean, there's not a lot of listings here, and there's a lot of hotels, and I think there's a lot of other reasons why hotel occupancy rates are so low around here. He seemed to be just trying to throw Airbnb under the bus.
For now, Airbnb guests and hosts and those hotels are waiting to see if local governments take that first step toward regulation. I'm Ryan Denham.
Take a closer look at the local hotel occupancy rates with an interactive graphic at our website. The address is WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The 4th of July holiday is all about mom and apple pie, as well as the nation's founding. Here's a different story of motherhood. Brenda Huber took part in a Next to Normal story slam at Night Shop in Bloomington earlier this year. She agreed to offer her experience of motherhood for GLT.
Nan sat on the edge of the bed with a syringe in one hand and my hand in the other. I didn't know it, but I had just made my last of 7 trips driving while ovulating across town to pick up these little vials of frozen hope from the FedEx office so we could inseminate before I headed into work. What the process lacked in romance, it made up for in spirituality. We looked to the cosmos and we said, "We invite you. If there's a soul who wants to come and walk with us to be part of this family, we welcome you." And he did. I always wanted to be a mother, just not a wife. I was raised in the Apostolic Christian Church, where girl children were raised with the expectation that they would marry some nice brother who would become the protagonist of their story and with whom they would raise their own children to perpetuate that tradition. As I watched my friends, one by one, begin to marry at 17, 18, or 19 years of age, I wept at their loss and determined that I wanted more. I chose from a field of 2 acceptable choices, teacher and nurse. And upon graduating in 1989, I dedicated my days to instructing other people's children. Not long after, despite the scolding of church members, I became a foster parent. They felt that I was taking matters into my own hands and running ahead of God, and they cautioned me to wait for God's timing to have my own children. 10 years later, after I had educated myself out of any potential suitors in the AC Church and settled down with a nice girl, I was on my doctoral internship in Pennsylvania when I began quietly perusing sperm banks on the internet. I was full of hopes and doubts. Could I be a mother? What if I regretted it? Was I good enough? It certainly wasn't something that would happen by accident. One day, as I was stewing in these questions, I saw an image of myself in my mind's eye, holding a newborn, gazing into his face, thinking, "Wow, I almost didn't do this." After we returned home in the summer of 2000, we went for our first doctor's appointment with a studious little man who flipped back and forth through this thick file, avoiding eye contact with us as we talked. Later, I learned that he had another patient by the same name whose file he was looking in as we spoke. It's an amusing story now in retrospect, but at the time, we absorbed each of his comments in a jumble of emotion. "How long have you been trying?" he asked. "We haven't," I said. "We're just getting started trying to find out what our options are." "Well, you're so old," he said. "Why didn't you start sooner?" "We're just now feeling ready." "Well, at your age, you have about a 7% chance of conception. And with frozen sperm, you cut that percentage in half," he gesticulated in the air with his hands as if to say, "It's a crapshoot. Can't you get fresh sperm?" My mind flashed to me standing alongside the road holding a cardboard sign reading, "Will work for fresh sperm." "No," I said. "We considered that, but no." Needless to say, we took our disheartened selves out of his office and began looking for a doctor with a bit more hope. It may be an understatement to say that my family had some mixed feelings about my plans to have children with no husband. My brother stopped me at a family event to say, "We just want you to know that we're praying you don't get pregnant." I said, "Do you realize how cruel that statement is? You might as well come out and say, we're praying that your deepest heart's desires never are realized." I confronted my mom and my brothers and said, there's no halfway on this. I will not have people in my life who tolerate my dreams. If you cannot participate in this process with unadulterated joy, then you will no longer have the opportunity to be engaged in my life. Period. You are either all in or all out. And then we found our sperm donor, a generous man who was willing to share information about his life and even agreed to meet any potential offspring when they turned 18. Having worked with so many children who longed to understand their roots, it was really important to me to be able to provide this to our children. Just as meaningful to us was the fact that our donor wanted to know about us before he was willing to release his sperm from the sperm bank. He was completely unlike me, but so like my partner's dad and my dad, a scientist and inventor. It dawned on me, I guess my genes will already be included. It's everyone else's characteristics that need to be represented. I was pregnant a short time with vial number 4. I got pregnant a second time, and after we had seen this precious little personhood beating on ultrasound, I miscarried again. The day of the DNC, the nurses in the Catholic hospital kept asking me suspiciously, "Are you sure the baby's dead?" Grieving and crying out to God, I encouraged this little soul to try one more time to get through. On September 11th, 2002, we inseminated. And about 10 days later, we met with a fertility specialist who said, "You have something in your uterus, maybe a cyst. If you're not pregnant, we need to take a look at that." The day of my dissertation defense, for the third time, I saw a plus sign emerge on the pregnancy test. I was ecstatic and also terrified that I would lose this little life again. The specialist put me on 10 times the amount of progesterone I'd been on before and monitored the fetus's development closely. He could tell by the cell division that I had conceived 5 full days after insemination. I was certain it was a miracle. Finally, on June 11th, 2003, he arrived by way of emergency C-section. The doctor exclaimed, "The cord is once, twice, 3 times around, and a true knot. We have ourselves a miracle baby." Well, our miracle baby is turning 15 this year. He came home from school a while back and said, "My friends think it's weird that I've never met my biological father." I said, "You want to hear something even weirder? I've never met your biological father." But in just 3 years, we will. We'll meet the man whose generosity brought my lifelong dream of motherhood miraculously to life.
Brenda Huber telling her story of motherhood. Another Next to Normal Story Slam happens Friday, July 27th at 8:30 p.m. at the McLean County Arts Center. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. As we approach the national holiday, here's another story that cuts against the grain of traditional myth and gender roles. This one from Livingston County. It's the story of a Civil War soldier who, like many, fought for the Union cause. This soldier was keeping a secret. Tara McClellan McAndrew wrote about it, and she spoke with IPR's Sean Crawford.
We're talking about a person who went by the name of Albert Cashier. Who are we talking about here?
Albert, to this day, is a mystery, as I talk about in the story. Most people, when you think of Albert Cashier, think of the Civil War soldier who fought for Company G of the 95th Regiment of the Illinois Infantry for 3 years during the Civil War. Albert was, what we know for sure, born in Ireland. And then it's kind of fuzzy, frankly, until about 1862, when Albert showed up in Sonneman, Illinois, as a handyman and enlisted in the war, and we know fought for 3 years, was known for his bravery, and much later, decades later, was discovered to be a woman.
This was a secret that was able to be kept throughout all of that time in the Civil War, and we're talking about close quarters, working with other soldiers, living with other soldiers, and apparently nobody was aware of it.
Exactly, which from our modern perspective, we find hard to believe, right? So when I was interviewing some of the experts about this, and I talked to 3 historians, and specifically one has studied in great detail Civil War women soldiers, They've all written books related to this topic, if not directly on this topic. And one of them said that from our modern perspective, thinking of modern armies who have to go through very in-depth, intimate physical exams to be admitted, that wasn't the case back then. There were virtually no physical exams. In essence, you go to the office to enlist. A person looks at you for what they can see might be an impediment, like a missing limb. Do you have a cough that could indicate tuberculosis? And that might be the full extent of your physical exam. And at the time, too, remember that there were a lot of underage boys who were enlisting. And so a woman who was disguising herself as a man could have easily passed for an underage boy. Now, the question, so we have two questions here. One is, how the heck did they get through the enlistment part? Well, it was easier than we think. Plus, there were no identifications back then to identify you as male or female or even verify your address, say. No social security cards, no birth certificates. That made it easier. But how do you get by with being a woman disguised as a man once you're in the field, literally 24/7, with your regiment? Well, that appears to be easier than we think, too. They, according to the experts I interviewed, the soldiers did not fully undress in front of each other typically. They relieved themselves in the woods alone. There was no dressing room, so to speak. Actually, it wasn't as hard as it appears to us from our modern perspective.
So Albert Cashier is able to go through the Civil War, gets out of the army, but as you mentioned, continued to live this life for many years. And then how was it discovered that Albert was actually a woman?
It was about 50 years after Cashier had been mustered out of service for the Civil War, that he was working for, I couldn't tell if it was a former or a current state senator named Ira Lish. And he was working on a car for Lish. And there was an accident of some sort. It sounds like maybe the car ran over his leg and broke it, and he had to have a physical exam. And the doctor who did that discovered the secret that he had been born a woman. And he begged the doctor, the story goes, and his employer, Lish, to please keep it a secret. And they allegedly did. He was very disabled at this point. And Lish, his employer, helped him get into the Illinois Soldiers and Sailors Home at Quincy. Lish asked the officials there to also keep the gender a secret like Cashier requested. But it did get out. And once it got out, it spread throughout the country. There were a number of articles done about Cashier being a woman who fought in the Civil War, and they were printed by newspapers everywhere.
But it turns out from the research that you've done and talked with others that this was not the only case of this happening, that there is an estimate of hundreds of women actually serving during the Civil War.
Exactly. The current estimates are somewhere between 500 to 1,000 women, disguised as men, of course, fought for both the North and South during the Civil War. But we will never know how many exactly there were because historians are convinced that there were women who disguised themselves as men and were never discovered, unlike Cashier. One thing that I found very interesting about this story is the reception that Cashier received and other women received who worked for the armies during the Civil War in a variety of capacities. And the reception that the public gave them could vary. One of the experts I talked to, Deanne Blanton, who is an expert on 19th century army records at the National Archives, she commented about this.
Most women soldiers, if they were confronted by what they had done, they were very, very quick to say that they did it for love. Love of a man. I went with my husband. I couldn't bear to be away from him. Or I loved my country so much. You know, women who said they did it for love, it tended to get sort of a pass.
So I guess a question would be, is it fair to say that Albert Cashier was transgender as we know it today?
That's an excellent question. And what one historian whom I interviewed, who also studies gender studies, said is, by definition, Cashier is transgender because Cashier voluntarily lived for the majority of his life as a gender other than his biological gender, which was female.
Tara McClellan McAndrew wrote about the story of Civil War soldier Albert Cashier for Illinois Issues, and you heard it on GLT's Sound Ideas.
Hello, it's me, President Trump.
And me, Bernie Sanders.
And there's only one thing that we agree on, and that's that everyone should listen to the Capitol Steps July 4th radio show. It is going to be stupendous.
I haven't heard a radio show this funny since my good friend Thomas Alva Edison told me about wireless transmission.
And I'm going to be singing many patriotic songs, and I know all the words, believe me.
So tune in to the Capitol Steps 4th of July special right here on this public radio station.
It's the Capitol Steps at noon and 6 p.m. Wednesday on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Any Shakespeare production is going to be loaded with talent. The script, the actors, the set designers, the director. But there are some moments, some emotions that the stage players themselves simply can't do on their own. That's where the sound designer comes in. GLT's Ryan Denham visited the man behind the music at this summer's Illinois Shakespeare Festival in Bloomington.
What you're hearing is some of the original score for Henry V, one of three main shows this summer at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. The festival's sound designer is Tony Reimer, who's pulling double duty this year. He's also composing original music for all three shows. We visited Reimer at the festival's outdoor theater at Illinois State University's Ewing Cultural Center in Bloomington, as he and the rest of the crew were getting ready for this week's opening night.
Probably about close to an hour's worth of original music. The interesting thing about theater is you're not composing things that are long. You know, the general duration is 15, 20 seconds. Occasionally you'll go up for an underscoring piece. It might be a minute or so, but there's also times where it's like you have to have a beginning, middle, and end that you wrap up in 5 or 10 seconds. It's a very different kind of composition from what you'd find in a concert hall.
What's the relationship between the sound effects that you're kind of working with on the design side and then the music compositions themselves? Like, people be hearing them simultaneously, overlapping on each other?
So I came to sound design through composition. And so for me, I don't really view them as separate entities. Certainly in the case of these shows, the sound effects are integrated within the composition, not necessarily in musical ways, but in at least textural or palette, you know, as part of a palette. Especially with Henry V, for example, a lot of the quote unquote music is really just sound effects that are being manipulated and organized in a way that supports the instruments that I'm using.
So how long have you been composing music?
It's been 30 some odd years. My very first sound design and composition for a theatrical production was for an adaptation of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre way back as an undergrad. And caught the bug pretty bad. I got bit pretty bad and have not really ever put it down since. It's been something I've been doing throughout my entire adult life.
From the outside looking in, it just seems really intimidating to be staring at nothing, a blank piece of paper, a computer, whatever, and just have nothing in front of you, and then suddenly there's something. How do you start composing a new work?
So a lot of times there's the director will sometimes come in with, hey, I want something that sounds a lot like this composer, or I want something that sounds like this movie. It's different on a show by show basis. For example, with Merry Wives of Windsor, we're saying that in the 70s, and so there's a wide variety of popular music from the 70s. So I look to sitcoms and popular music of the day as motivation.
So with Merry Wives, as that's placed in the 70s on this stage, so are we going to be hearing, are you sampling songs that folks might have heard into your own original composition? What's going to be kind of the blend of original versus maybe stuff that will evoke a moment in the 70s?
Sure. So the goal with Merry Wives, so we have restrictions with respect to licensing of music. And so within the show, the music is derivative of other pieces of that era, but, you know, and there are definitely some quotes in there. There's definitely some, parody that's going on, but it's not, I'm not using any pre-recorded material within the show. So but for the house music and for intermission and for walkout music, we're free to use commercial music then. And so the challenge in that case becomes creating music that works within the show that sounds like it belongs with that other music. And that can be quite challenging because I'm a single person, whereas, you know, I don't play bass, I don't play guitar, but I have to kind of fake it. With Henry V, we're actually creating our own world altogether. In that case, I drew a lot of inspiration from the set, as well as the costume design, in terms of looking at something visually and saying, hey, what can I do musically that's going to fit inside this world? And in an aid to that, I mean, I consume a lot of popular, a lot of media, a lot of TV, a lot of film. And so when I see something, it'll call to mind some other film or some other TV show I saw. And it's like, oh, maybe I try something like that. And then it's just about, analyzing what made that music in that show, in that film, make me think of this and leverage that to generate ideas.
And with Henry V, you said you're trying to do something different. You're trying to create a whole world, mm-hmm. and aid in the creation of that world with the music. So what is the vibe of that world? What is the feeling you're trying to capture?
With respect to the music specifically, I'm using a lot of distortion, as an effect. So almost any given sound cue within that show has some distorted element, which falls in line with the production team's kind of overall vision for the show, which is, things are recognizable, but they're somehow not quite right. The distortion in this case also helps with respect to, this is a play about battle. This is a play about power. And so in that case, I started with a composer I'd been listening to quite a bit, Ben Frost. He did the soundtrack for a show called Fortitude, which is an Amazon series. And also look to Hans Zimmer's recent score for the recent Blade Runner movie as kind of inspiration for his, as taking off point, and then kind of melding that and trying to make that work within the context of a Shakespearean history, which has certain functional things that you need to accommodate. We have to have calls, horn calls or signaling across space.
What about Shakespeare in Love? What's the mood and the tone you're trying to capture there?
So Shakespeare in Love is very. So Shakespeare in Love is the only piece this summer we're doing that's period. In that instance, as you probably know, it's the play is an adaptation of the movie, Tom Stoppard's words are really, really great there. So a lot of times as a sound designer, especially within the context of Shakespeare in Love, is like, just try not to bump into the furniture or whatever. I'm trying to stay out of the way. So in that case, that work has the most period instruments, which is kind of a challenge. Technology wasn't very far along in Shakespeare's day, so the musical instruments were not nearly as advanced as what we have now. And so that presents a lot of challenges from a compositional standpoint. But it is an adaptation of a movie, so we get to cheat a little because it's a movie. In that case, using a lot of very lush orchestrations, a much bigger orchestra than it ever would have actually existed in the period.
So the soundtrack for the film, Shakespeare in Love, is pretty well known. I think it won an Oscar for Best Score at the time. So folks may be familiar with that melody that was sort of the dominant thread in that film. So how do you let that, something like that, influence you as you're sitting down to do your work, or do you just try to separate yourself completely?
So no, I definitely because it is a really great score, and I don't generally dismiss all input is good input. But in our case, because we aren't on stage, we don't have smash cuts and things like that. It necessarily needs to be a little bit different. So in terms of texture and orchestration and feel, I feel like I do honor or give a nod to that film score. But thematically or whatever, kind of just blew all that up. I'm going to work with my own themes. It's just easier to manage that within the context of a whole production.
Illinois Shakespeare Festival sound designer and composer Tony Reimer speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham. The festival opens this week with The Merry Wives of Windsor. This summer's other two main shows are Henry V and Shakespeare in Love. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Let us know what you think of the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM.